Recording the 19th of June, 2011. Paula Fenn.
I was a student of Gwen Koldovsky's starting in 1973 to 74, and I started again in 77, and I finished up a doctorate with her in 82. That's quite a long time ago. Madame Koldovsky, as she was known, although she used to twinkle every time anyone called her that. She thought of herself as Mrs. Koldovsky. Thank you. Always had an aura. I remember the first time when I met her, I thought, oh my, I'm going to be studying with the Queen Mother. And in many respects, it was a bit like the Queen Mother in the sense that she had seen so much during the course of her long life. We traded gossip about the Prince of Wales, the infamous Prince of Wales, who left his crown for Mrs. Simpson and all the ladies he knew. I'm sorry I never got a little further into this when I started my research on Harriet Cohen, but there was a sort of twinkle in her eye the one time she mentioned Harriet Cohen, but also the musical figures that she mentioned as well. Marguerite Hasselmann, with whom she studied with in Paris, and Harold Craxton, with whom she studied in England. I happened to know Harold's daughter, Janet, strangely enough, who was a clarinet player. So because Gwen had spent so much time in England, we had a lot to talk about because I was married to an Englishman. And sometimes my John would come, and she just loved that English accent. As far as how she taught, even near the end, and I kept bringing her stuff and asking her questions till long after I had finished my degree. Even at the end, when she was wearing hearing aids, you couldn't get anything past her. Suddenly, everything just apparently was registering loud and clear, and she had wonderful ears. She was always kind. I think she swore at me twice, but I come from the school of thought that she did it because she cared. The other thing is that I and some other students remember that now and then, if there's something she didn't like, you'd get this little punch in the back. And she could pack a punch, you know. She was little, but she had very, very strong hands, thank you. As far as my lessons, she didn't speak much. Occasionally, she would say, watch this and watch that. We had a very wonderful relationship. She was very kind to me. I think one of the first things she ever said to me when I began study was, I'm going to tell you things that you already know but no one has ever said to you, which was immensely flattering. And a lot of the lessons took the form of me saying, just play it for me, then I'll know. And she would oblige. I must say we had a very interesting situation when I brought in the Duparc song, Extase. Now, keep in mind that I was a youngster in my 20s, and ecstasy was something very, very immediate, thank you. And Gwen, at this point, God, she must have been in her 70s. And ecstasy was, from her standpoint, something different to mine. And it was, it was, in retrospect, very amusing to compare the two versions. But she was very, in many respects, hands-off with the way she treated me. I am forever grateful to her for trusting me. We had a requirement at USC that we had to play the recital before her and Mr. Smith.
Brooke Smith.
This is Brooke Smith, the great Brooke Smith, 30 days beforehand. And because during my doctorate, I was commuting in, none of this happened. And both she and he trusted me enough to waive this requirement. Otherwise, I would have been flying in all sorts of people, particularly on the recital where there were piles of people. I must say, I did solve this problem by flying the two of them to Tucson in one case when we had a bit of a cast of thousands, and they were very happy to come. I will say that she and he, she, Gwendolyn Koldovsky, and Brooke Smith, were wonderfully supportive of each other, and there was an astounding mutual respect. And this is not necessarily astonishing, but one does have to remember that they were very different. And there were occasions, in my particular case, I would sometimes, well, on many occasions, have a lesson with her 1 hour, then go downstairs and have a lesson with him on the same repertoire. And sometimes it didn't always marry up. But I remember there was this wonderful, wonderful mutual regard and respect between these two giants of the profession.
How were they different in their approaches or their feelings for the music?
Mr. Smith had a nickname. We called him Mr. Clean. And I certainly needed him when I first came out from Arizona. Brooks made sure everything was squeaky clean, that your pedaling was pristine. I remember him looking at my fingering, which has always been and continues to be a bit of a sight reader's fingering, shall we say, to put it nicely. And he would look at me and say, "You know, dear, this is rather exotic." Gwen was nothing like that. She was more, it was more a question of the overall construction, feel. I won't say that he neglected interpretation, and she didn't speak a great deal about interpretation to me, but it was just two different views, and they came at it from other ends. There were a few pieces in which we all prayed that we were not going to be asked for them on our juries because they had very different ideas of the tempo. But there were, I think, maybe two or three that we just sort of shuddered to think that we would be asked to play with them. And they were both in the front row, that we would make one of them unhappy because we loved them both dearly. The people in my class, I don't know about classes afterward, we took great delight in organizing dinners with the two of them, both Gwen and Brooks presiding, and the rest of the class around them. We would go out. Gwen also invited us to her place on Los Feliz Drive to tea. How appropriate. And it was preceded by a visit to the Huntington Museum. And how appropriate as well. And we had a great time, but it was really very, very lovely to see the beloved Madame K take her shoes off and walk in her stockinged feet through the grass of the museum. It was very, very sweet. Less sweet was the drive on the freeway to her home. Some of us were riding with her, and it was a little bit of a white-knuckle experience. But once we got there, it was lovely. The home, of course, was the old Dempsey estate. And I think she had the house that was used for the screening of films. And it had a great long staircase, and it was very, very elegant. She shared her home, of course, with her brother and his wife for many, many years. And, you know, we were always made welcome. In the later years, I would visit her at the house more often than at the studio because, well, she had retired. And she was very, very generous with her time. I remember saying, "Well, you know, I need to pay you for my lessons now." And she sort of murmured a bit. And then I made an offer that was based on what some people I know were paying people in New York. And she sort of shook her head and said, "No one is worth that much." That was Gwen. You know, she was, of course, elegant and imposing in the most genteel sort of way, but she was incredibly real as a person and very, very practical. She had an immense sense of humor. We used to tease each other about what we looked like, and she always felt that I looked like a cat, which is rather appropriate, especially now that I have 22 of them. And I said, "And what do you look like?" And she made a face, and she said, "I've always thought I looked like some sort of a bird." And she put on a sort of beaky face. So that was Gwen, a great, great lady.
Can you talk about the actual lessons, how often you had singers there, and that sort of thing?
We, as master students, would interact with her three times a week. We would have our individual lessons, and if we had something to play for, we would haul someone in. And, of course, as master students, we were supposed to play two recitals, one with a singer and one with instrumentalists. And sometimes your people could make it, and sometimes they couldn't. In my particular case, when I was doing my doctorate with her, I was flying in, literally flying in, from Tucson, Arizona, once a week. And I would be having lessons on literature that I was due to play in Arizona or elsewhere. And so most of the time, I didn't have a partner. So once again, she was she just trusted me, and it was very kind of her. She did make reference to instinct and a sort of ESP, and she called it the unteachable. And with my sort of warped sense of humor, I thought it sounded like a disease. But she did say that in my class of 10, only two people had the unteachable. And
you were one of them.
And I was one of them.
And this unteachable is an instinctual feeling for the right style, or how you follow or lead a...
You just know. I'm going to tell you something a little bit odd. You know, and those people who have had teachers that they have enjoyed and come to love and have kept up correspondence with or contact with, try this sometime. I remember being, once again, Miss Mouth here, asking both Gwen and Brooks what they thought of me when they first heard me. Mm. And
this is after years of working.
This was after years of working. And Gwen looked at me and she smiled and she said, "You know, you were quite crazy, you know, but I think what she was trying to say is that I was always trying to make something happen." Brooks was much more succinct, which was probably in keeping with his image as Mr. Clean. And he said, "Well, dear, your playing always said something. It may not have been the right thing, but it always said something." And so, you know, now as a teacher myself, and all of you out there who are teachers, you know, in many respects, it's far easier to get a student to scale back on an impulse than to add something that doesn't seem to be there, or coax a student who is particularly reticent into wearing his or her heart on the sleeve, even for a moment. And so I guess it worked out all right. But both of them were extremely kind to me. Brooks and I would sometimes drive up to Casa Dorinda up in Santa Barbara after Gwen had retired there. And for those of you who don't know the estate, and indeed it was an estate, it was lovely with libraries and reading rooms and a library that had a grand piano in it. And I remember Brooks and I driving up there, and we thought we would bring up some music and we would sight read up there for Gwen. And so we installed ourselves in the library, and Gwen was sitting there on the couch, and Brooks and I started to read. And we were sight reading, and Brooks was a wonderful reader, and he always would make me read, and I like to think I wasn't too shabby. And so we're sort of sitting there doing our thing, and we hadn't talked about anything beforehand. We would just let the book fly open, and we would play. I think there was a great deal of Mozart going on. And we were joined in the library by another resident of Casa Dorinda. And he joined Gwen in the applause, and he uttered the words, "That was really splendid, almost professional." And Gwen rose like a dragon and essentially told this man off. Now, there was no reason to tell her off for me, the likes of me, but certainly for Brooks Smith. And I remember this man saying brokenly, I'm sorry, I should have known better. I'm a violinist. I was a violinist." And Brooks and I were just doing our pieces laughing because, you know, just we were reading. And of course we knew it wasn't concert quality, but we were entertaining our dear, dear friend Gwen. But you should have seen her. Man, she went for him.
It's a good story. It tells a lot about her.
Yes, yes, yes. She was for real. Both of them were for real. She always maintained that people who work with other people, collaborators as we are now called, have to be flexible as personalities. And, you know, that was her line. We accompanists must be flexible. And she used the A word. You know, I don't know whether we ever discussed the C word with her or not. But that was Gwen.
What was her approach to you as an accompanist, learning the A word, sorry, learning the poetry?
She sort of took it for granted that I'd do it.
But what if it were a language that you didn't understand? How did you...
Well, you know, it was sort of expected that you figured it out by the time you got there.
Uh-huh.
One of the things she was very, very conscious of was sound. And for those of you who remember her playing, she had a really incredibly beautiful sound. And she would sometimes characterize tone. And she said that I had, my sound was a Schumann sound, which I guess was a good thing if I was playing Schumann.
Right.
But I remember when I took Frauenliebundleben in to her, her playing the opening of Seit ich ihn gesehen for me. And those chords, my ears went up and I said, now that is really beautiful.
The voicing of the chords?
It was just the sound. It was just the sound. Because there's, you know, it was just the sound. So I remember going downstairs into the practice rooms in Clark House and sitting there for an hour playing those same chords over and over and over until I could find the sound. She was not a recipe person with me. She didn't tell me how to do it. She just sort of gave me sort of an inkling of what she wanted.
And by demonstrating?
Sometimes demonstrating, just sometimes singing to me. I remember also playing the end of Dichterliebe for her. And I just remember playing that postlude, and she walked away from me as if to see what it would sound like in a hall.
Mm-hmm.
And I finished, and she just smiled at me. So I guess it was okay. No, she didn't say that much to me. She did swear at me twice because there was something that wasn't quite right. But that was it.
Was she demanding of you that you memorize or have a lot of repertoire in your fingers?
She did not demand memorization. I knew she did because, you know, a lot of times she turned pages for herself. And I remember her playing Botschaft of Brahms, which is, you know, it takes some doing. And I saw her miss the page, and she just finished it.
Yeah.
You know, so there. I never had that sort of talent, you know. So she, and we never talked about memorization. And as far as a repertoire under the fingers, I was a pretty busy girl, and so I usually had a lot of stuff that I was hauling around. And I usually had plenty to play.
Did you work on a non-song literature, instrumental literature with her, or opera aria literature with her?
I didn't do arias so much. I did a lot of chamber music and a lot of song repertoire. Had she
accompanied her husband?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Tell
who the husband was.
Her husband was Adolf Koldovsky, the British-Canadian violinist, who I think it's the Opus 47 or the 49 of Schoenberg is dedicated to him. And he was a conductor as well. And occasionally she would tell me stories about him, particularly the one where she went on tour and he went on tour. And it was either he had changed the locks or moved house while he was gone. But anyway, she had a lot of twinkles in her eye when she talked about Adolf. And she had a picture of him on her piano. And so we always knew who Adolf was. And occasionally, I think when I was studying the Franck Sonata, which is dedicated to Isaiah, Adolf apparently studied with Izai, and she made mention of some little things that Adolf Koldovsky had handed down to her.
Wow,
and
that's nice.
So it was nice, you know, when you study with someone who has an incredible pedigree and an incredible tradition to pass on. It's really quite something, because she saw so much, she experienced so much in her long life, and knew so many great artists. Those of us in my class and in the decades that followed, I can't quite remember when she and Brooks retired, had an incredible resources at our fingertips to have these two practitioners of our art, these two pioneers in the art of accompanying or collaborative piano, whatever you want to call it, to draw upon.
She established the collaborative piano as a course there, or was that established by Brooks?
No, she did. She was the great pioneer, and it was she that that established the doctorate in collaborative piano, specifically for Jean Barr, who is number one. She got the first doctorate, DMA, I think it's an AMUS doc at USC, in collaborative piano. So, you know, she was the great pioneer. So that was the place to go. And when, I believe, Brooks was brought down because Heifetz was on the faculty at that time. I believe that's the reason that he came down. And it was pretty rich time, because in Clark House, you know, I nearly knocked over Yasha Heifetz when I was running from Clark House to main campus. You know, you go flying out the back door, you nearly knock over this guy in a Hamburg hat, and you go, "Oh dear, that is Yasha Heifetz, you nearly smushed." And luckily for me, I think he always liked Asian women. Okay. And then, of course, you'd run into Piatigorsky also on the first floor. Piatigorsky, who didn't feel like going upstairs to the men's room or downstairs to the men's room, but who used the restroom under the stairs, which was designated women, but he didn't particularly care. Those were interesting times back in the old Clark House.
To sum up, is there something when you're teaching now that you feel is a direct line with Gwen, or does that all get filtered and really becomes Paula Fan?
The aspect of sound is still very much Gwen. You know, I am hoping that my students play those same chords over and over and over, trying to find that sound, although I am a little bit more specific about how to get that sound than Gwen was. And the other thing is a number of the traditions she handed down about performance of some of the, we'll call them the classic song literature, if you will. Some of the pauses, some of the traditions, and they are once again being handed down, you know, through me.
Are you talking about pauses between songs in a cycle, for instance?
No, it's just some of the phrasing, some of the tempo changes that are unmarked.
Uh-huh. Specifically, Widmung B section.
No, I never thought about that, because it once again, she would sing to me more than sing to me or and play to me more than she would talk to me. It's just things that I'd remember from what she would
do. Did she have an opinion about that particular? I mean, there's quite a lot of controversy about whether you take the B section in Widmung slower or not.
Mm-hmm. And actually, I don't remember her telling me to.
She.
No,
or
I don't.
Depends on your singer, perhaps.
It depends on my singer, but just in terms of Let's see. First of all, I can't remember what it's marked. I don't think it's marked.
I don't think it's marked.
It's
either.
Not marked, and however the note value changes, and you know when you start thinking about tempo, and you think how a composer gives the illusion of a different tempo by changing note value. Brahms does this quite a lot.
Sure.
It's very, very interesting. This is where you know I get to the point where I start talking to myself about it. And this is something that Gwen never did. We did not discuss. It was just a very sort of, wasn't even intuitive. It was to me it seemed very, very logical, but the way we communicated was sort of cellular in terms, it was sort of cell to cell. It was back and forth. Well, we didn't yak a lot.
If I may take a second section, like a B section, and talk about Nacht und Träume. How do you prepare the shift?
Oh, the shift to the, was it submediant?
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's always the question of, now you have to remember, we're all products of many teachers. And as my husband would say, my late husband would say, you can't give people musical whiplash, can you? So
you gently into it.
Yeah. And actually, I think probably, in retrospect, there are a few marks. I don't have a lot of marks from Gwen. I have a few. Just a sort of wiggly line here and odds and ends here. My scores are not heavily marked by her. It, again, was... it just happened.
Well, this may be respect that she had for you, the experience you already brought to it, and your own native musicality.
Who knows? We just had a great time. We had a grand time after I got over being afraid of her.
It lasted...
about one semester. Then I just decided, well, I'm going to make her laugh. It's funny because speaking of electronics and that sort of thing, you know, Gwen was very, I won't say leery of technology, but we always used to cringe during song lit because she would try and drop the needle, and drop the needle it was. You know, you would think, scrape.
So she taught song lit class.
She taught song lit class.
Oh, my God. Can you mention the various, may I assume that it was mostly melody and Lieder, or can you correct me on that?
Oh, we did a little bit of everything.
Swedish song...
English song, definitely English song. And what was very interesting is those of you who know the Warlock song, Sleep, with its rather unusual ending harmonically. She remembered when it was first played. And she said, oh, what an impact that made. You know, you when you think about her in England... She would have overlapped essentially the generation or two beyond the English Renaissance, you know, the Stanford Parry Renaissance. Mm-hmm. I do remember the text, which was highly soporific, the Dennis Stevens History of Song. And I also remember her project. We would do timelines. And that was very, very useful to see how song developed in different countries. And to this day, I still have my students do some sort of a timeline because it is fascinating to see how song in different countries, at what point in history, the ingredients are right to come up with a body of great song literature. And it, you know, it varies. And it's amazing to realize how many countries, in how many countries it took the 20th century to do so. Mm-hmm. So
Sweden being one, I mean, maybe the last 20 years of the 19th century was okay in Sweden, but really the 20th century for me is Swedish.
Well, you know, you start looking at even the Spaniards. You know, when you think
that 20th century for them,
a number of them went to Paris to find out how to write Spanish music. Excuse me, I mean Carmen was.
It worked.
Yeah, it worked. It worked. Mm-hmm.
Are there any specifics, because the listeners to this will love any specifics that Gwen said, you mentioned the Brahms, and I'm thinking of...
Kirchhoffer, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Kirchhoffer, Kirchhoffer. Where you leave the storm behind and it becomes quarter notes for the last page.
Mm-hmm.
And again, an implied change of tempo just because of how it looks.
Mm-hmm.
Would she have talked about that sort of thing?
Not to me.
Okay.
Not to me. Mm-hmm. But it'll be fascinating to, so to speak, compare notes with mm-hmm. other students. Mm-hmm. We did have class in which there were five pairs of us, and so we learned quite a lot of repertoire that way. But the thing that made
pairs mean singer,
singer and pianist, okay. Yeah. That we met twice a week. But I only was in residence for two semesters in that sort of class that I could participate. For my doctorate, I commuted for 4.5 years, and so I never worked with a partner. And so what is mostly stuck in the memory are these one-on-one lessons. And of course, keeping in mind that first semester that I was in residence, I was scared out of my skull. So I probably was a deer in front of headlights. I don't remember a blessed thing.
When you went back for your private lessons, though, you were going back for specific things that you were preparing for tour or for Arizona. And do you remember anything specific that she was giving you there? You went a long distance to visit her.
I was actually pursuing a doctorate, and my doctorate there was somewhat unusual because essentially, as far as repertoire was concerned, I was calling the shots.
Oh, okay.
And neither of them, again, it's, I guess, I am deeply touched at the trust they placed in me. They didn't tell me what to do when it came to what to play. Occasionally, Brooks would have me sight read just to introduce me to stuff, but that's about it. I usually had a pile full of stuff to haul in.
Mm-hmm.
Gwen really never talked very much about fingering with me. Brooks did. It was just really a situation in which they were very complimentary mm-hmm. with an E. Mm-hmm. Not you're a very nice pianist, although they were very sweet to me. But, you know, what she didn't do, he did, and what he didn't do, she did. So I had an ideal sort of situation.
It sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
It sounds great.
It really was something. Mm-hmm. So I remember them both with great fondness and great love. And I was very glad that I was able to visit her really to the end of her life, you know, in Casa Dorinda, and just have some good times. You know, go up and just talk about music, sometimes not about music, sometimes politics. She was no longer Madame K, she was Gwen. I remember when I graduated, she gave me a graduation present. It was a musical dictionary, and she signed it, bless her heart. It's not sincerely or best wishes. She signed it devotedly, Gwen.
Wow.
And I will always